She's one of the greatest Americans to ever live, Helen Keller. And now you're going to meet the man who's taken over the organization she started, Dr. Kirk Adams, today on Driven by Purpose.
This is Driven by Purpose, a show about finding your purpose, building fulfilling careers, and helping people with disabilities live better lives. Hosted by three men who've lived it and are here to help you do the same. Special thanks to our presenting sponsor, Clean Logic, a leading bath and skincare company and a true pioneer in creating inclusive workplaces and increasing employment opportunities for people with disabilities.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Driven by Purpose. My name is Evan Rosenblum, along with the co-founder of Clean Logic and the Inspiration Foundation, Isaac Shapiro. Isaac, what's going on?
Good to see you, Evan. Excited for today's guest.
Oh, man, me too. Especially because there is a connection to Helen Keller, who is one of my heroes, and I can't wait to hear more about this person. Isaac, take it away.
Yes, I'm excited to introduce everybody to Dr. Kirk Adams. He's been a close friend of mine for close to 20 years. He's been a masterful individual of being a leader in the nonprofit space. He led the Seattle Lighthouse. He was the CEO of the American Foundation for the Blind, who was started by Helen Keller.
And then Kirk
has just been an amazing advisor to Clean Logic and one of the first people that really helped us really build what we have at Clean Logic and creating employment for individuals with disabilities, setting us up with the connection of Kathy West Evans. Kirk, did I leave anything out? I'm passing it right over to you because you're one of my favorites. So take it from here.
Well, I was thinking about our relationship, our history, and when I left the Lighthouse for the Blind in Seattle and took on the wonderful responsibility of leading the American Foundation for the Blind and moved from my quiet neighborhood in Seattle to New York City, one of the first people who came to see me in the AFB offices at Two Penn Plaza was you, Isaac.
Wow.
So you gave me a nice welcome into that new role, and I really appreciate it. And
that's amazing.
Just really, really excited about what you're building at Clean Logic and the Inspiration Foundation. It's been a pleasure to lend a hand here and there, and you're working on some great things.
Yeah, and I think where things have continued to be great is, you know, when Kirk left the American Foundation for the Blind, he went out. We wanted to bring him over at the Inspiration Foundation, but he was dedicated to his family and his new grandkids, and he started Innovative Impact. But Kirk, I would love for you to just tell us a little bit about your background. Most people in our audience who don't listen or are not seeing YouTube, you know, I'd love to hear the history about your dad, and you know, just tell us a little bit about yourself, and we'll go from there.
I was born a sighted child. My parents were in college. My dad was a college basketball player, and born during in the summer in between their sophomore and junior years, and they graduated from Western Washington, became teachers. I had a little brother came along a few years later, and I was 5 years old. I was in kindergarten, and got on the bus one day to go home, and it had snowed a little bit. And when I got off the bus, I could not tell where I was. I was so disoriented. A neighbor found me crying in her backyard and recognized me from the block and took me to my mom, you know, who knew right away there was something wrong. So she rushed me to the pediatrician, who rushed me to a ophthalmologist, who rushed me to the hospital, and both my retinas had detached.
Oh my gosh.
And I had an emergency retinal surgery that night, and this was before laser surgery. And thank goodness with medical technology now, so much can be done with detached retinas. But at that time, they actually had to go in and try to tack the retinas down with sutures, and it was unsuccessful. So I became totally blind really quickly. And you know, the neighborhood school in Linwood, Washington, told my parents, who were, you know, in their mid-20s, had never met a blind person before, had no knowledge, no support network. They said, well, he can't come back to school here. You know, he needs to go to the school for the blind kids. So they visited the Washington State School for the Blind in Vancouver and were very disappointed with what they saw there as far as academics. It's now an excellent school. But someone had told them that the Oregon State School was excellent. So we visited there and they loved it. And so they quit their jobs and moved the family to Silverton, Oregon, so I could go to the Oregon State School for the Blind. And I had a wonderful teacher named Mrs. Summers. And, you know, sometimes when you're in these settings and they say, you know, think about a person who really impacted your life. And I think of Mrs. Summers because she taught me for 3 years, first, second, third grade, how to read and write Braille, which liberated me and set me free in many ways. I was hospitalized a lot between age 5 and 12 and spent extended periods of time in a hospital bed after a surgery with my head in a clamp.
Oh my gosh.
I couldn't move my head. And so I read, and that just was transformational for me to learn Braille. And there was an O&M orientation mobility instructor named Mr. Pearson. He taught me how to travel, you know, confidently and gracefully with a long white cane. And I was taught how to type on a typewriter as a 6-year-old so that, you know, when my skills were up to the right level, I could go to public school. So I started public school in my little hometown in fourth grade and went on through sink or swim. And I was always the only blind kid in the district, you know, throughout my schooling. Actually, through college and master's and my doctoral program, I was always the only blind student. But they gave me three gifts at the school, which I didn't, of course, realize at the time. But now that I've done ethnographic research on how blind people become successful in the world of work, in professions and employment, I realized I was given three success factors. One was the blindness skills that I already mentioned. You know, the Braille, the cane travel. The other was high expectations. A lot of kids with disabilities, again, like born into my family, where no one had any exposure to people who were blind. Oftentimes, families and school districts and communities don't have high expectations of kids with disabilities, and sometimes those become internalized. And I mentioned before, my dad was a high school basketball coach and a very disciplined person, and he didn't want to see anything less than an A on a report card, and he expected his kids to be involved in after-school activities and athletics. So I wrestled and ran cross-country and downhill skied and cross-country skied and all the things. So I had high expectations from my family and the school. And then that strong internal locus of control, that sense of agency, you know, that I just knew in my bones without question that I could do whatever I set my mind to, and I could figure out how to get things done and overcome obstacles. And that's opposed to that strong external locus of control where you think, you know, all this stuff is happening to me. There's not much I can do about it. But as I did my dissertation work and I interviewed, you know, blind people employed in large American corporations, that really shone through, that everybody had that strong internal locus of control. And a lot of stories and instances of people gaining that through experiences, through outdoor experiences. One person I interviewed who'd been in the telecom industry for 45 years, she remembered going to summer camp with her twin sister who was sighted when she was 10. And the camp counselors, when it came for horseback riding, said, "No, you cannot ride the horses with the other kids. You know, you're blind. That's too dangerous. It's a liability." And she remembers she and her sister snuck out of the cabin at night and went to the stable and got out a couple of horses and rode the horses in the night. And you know, that gave her that sense that, you know, she talked about riding, you know, galloping on these horses with her sister through the night, and that just gave her that sense that she could do anything she wanted to do.
Dr. Adams, I have a question for you. When you were a kid and you're going through this, I mean, what you went through, that's traumatic. I mean, I couldn't imagine being a 5-year-old little boy, and then all of a sudden, one minute you're riding on a bus and everything is completely typical and you can see, and then in the next minute you're going through a surgery, your detached retinas, and your whole world shifts essentially overnight, the way you describe it. How did you cope with that? What strategies did you use to kind of deal with that and kind of come to terms with that? And then how do you use your experience to help kids that are kind of going through similar experiences now?
Well, I don't want to sugarcoat this, but it was trauma. It was childhood trauma. I didn't have those words or know it at the time. I was actually talking to a therapist 8 or 9 years ago about some things, and she said, "Well, you know, what have you done to address your childhood trauma?" And I said, "Childhood trauma?" And she said, "Yes, you, my friend, experienced childhood trauma." So there are some psychosocial things.
Sure.
That really weren't attended to. Like I said, my parents had high expectations. They were very creative. With no attachment to any other blind people or community. We just kind of figured stuff out. They were both from pioneer families, and they were used to getting things done and figuring things out. So we did that. Now, again, the school was really, really important, and me learning how to read and write, and I talked about that a little bit. But I was very successful, you know, academically. I found learning really interesting and engaging. I was a good student. And so that carried me through a lot of my life until about age 16, because I lived in little towns in the Pacific Northwest, farming towns. My dad was a high school basketball coach. And when kids turned 16, they got driver's licenses and they got jobs of some kind. So I had neither. So age 16, 17, 18 were pretty tough for me. I felt really isolated. The people I used to hang out with were now, off and away and automobiles doing this and that and going to their after school jobs and making money that they could spend, and I wasn't having that experience. So that was hard. And I want to recommend that people who are experiencing disability, it is can be a traumatic experience. There's a grief cycle. People have to change. There are parts of their lives that are no longer available to them. They need to be creative and fill their lives with other things, but that takes adjustment. So I would strongly recommend people seeking professional support through the journey. If you're experiencing discomfort because of your impairment, it's one thing to figure out how to get a job and go to work and pay your bills and those things, but there are psychological things that really important to acknowledge and address, I think.
So now you're in this position. What are some of the work that you've been doing is incredible. What are some of the goals that you've set for yourself now? In the role that you're in?
Well, it's interesting. I've spent 10 years in banking and finance. I was involved in tax-free municipal security underwriting with a small firm here in Seattle that was bought by a regional bank that was bought by a big bank. And after 10 years, I got pretty clear I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life. So I went through an intentional process. I got the What Color Is Your Parachute book out of the Talking Book and Braille Library and followed all the exercises, and at the end I got clear that I should really be in the nonprofit sector, and I should be in leadership roles, and I should be working to create easier pathways for other people who are blind. And so I set about doing that. I followed the book's advice and asked for informational interviews with CEOs of nonprofits here in Seattle that I admired.
Right.
And one of them, she was president of Planned Parenthood of Western Washington. She said, "Well, I was also a securities person. I made the transition to the nonprofit sector, and I think you should do that by becoming a professional fundraiser, because you spent the last 10 years talking to people about finance, and we have a crying need for professional resource development people." So I started applying for those types of jobs and not getting hired because I didn't have any experience. But I got a newsletter from the Talking Book and Braille Library saying they needed to raise $200,000 or close down the Evergreen Radio Reading Service. So I called the librarian and said, you know, how about I volunteer 20 hours a week to raise you the $200,000 that'll give me some experience, put something on my resume. So I did that. I got a book from reading a book on cassette from Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic about how to write a grant proposal. Listened to that and then started sending out letters of inquiry and grant proposals and had what I now know was beginner's luck and got a couple of big checks. And they said, could you stay on? We'll create a job for you. So my first nonprofit job was development officer for the Seattle Public Library Foundation, raising money for the Talking Book and Braille Library. Then I was hired by the Lighthouse for the Blind to set up their foundation and their fundraising board. And through a series of steps, I became the president and CEO there. And I want to say that they were very intentional about putting me in the position to be qualified for that. I'd been there about 5 years, and my predecessor, who was a sighted person, he was thinking about retiring, and he really felt it was important to have a blind person in that top role. So he asked me, you know, would you like to put in the time and effort to become qualified so that when my retirement comes, you can apply and be considered. So they hired a consultant. We mapped my knowledge, skills, and abilities against those that would be necessary. Wherever there was a gap, we put in a professional development plan. We worked on that for 15, 18 months. The prime example, the Lighthouse employs blind and deafblind people in businesses, and one is aerospace manufacturing, so making parts for all the Boeing aircraft. So I didn't have an aerospace background, so I needed to learn about the supply chain, you know, the AS9100, the ISO standard for aerospace. I needed to sit in on the annual Boeing contract negotiations. So that's an example of what they did to put me in that position. And then, you know, I was invited to join the board of the American Foundation for the Blind. And when my predecessor there was thinking about retirement, he pretty similarly pulled me aside and said, you know, I think you're the best person to lead AFB into the second century. Would you consider putting your name forward when I retire? And I talked to my wife of 40 years now, but, we just determined, you know, there's only one AFB. It's the most historic, iconic blindness organization, Helen Keller's organization. There's only one, I only have one career. I've been preparing for this. I was getting I was in my doctoral program in leadership and change. It just seemed like a moral obligation to me to step into that role.
On that note, like, what does it mean to be connected to that, to have that connection to Helen Keller? I mean,
she left her estate to AFB when she died in 1968. So all of her physical possessions were archived, and there was a full-time archivist. So all of her letters, you know, correspondence, drafts of her speeches or manuscripts, gifts that people, you know, heads of state from around the world had given her in her travels, her Oscar, all that stuff. And in those offices, in those offices in New York City, up on the 11th floor at the corner of 7th and 31st, right above Penn Station, as I heard the constant honking of horns and the noise from the street, I could walk down the hallway. They had established a little gallery in her honor, and I could sit at her desk.
So Kirk, one of the things I wanted to also add is that why I was in to talk to Kirk early was the prior CEO was just an amazing individual, blind himself. And I remember because I was living by coastal New York, one day I'm walking in New York City in the craziest time and it's so busy. And I'm like, wow, this is, how do people do this? And it's, you know, I'm earlier days and there's Carl just going down, you know, right there going to Penn Station to find a subway. And I'm like, Carl. And I'm like, wow, you do this every day. He's like, heck yeah, I do this all by myself. So just, you know, you had big shoes to fill. And that's
I had
to come there to talk to you.
Yeah, that was my personal greatest orientation and mobility accomplishment till we moved to Park Slope in Brooklyn. So I learned how to take the F train to J Street Metrotech and transfer to the A and going to Penn Station and, you know, up and onto 34th and into the office. So as a totally blind person who did not grow up riding subways, that was, I'm proud of that. I'm proud of being able to do that.
Can I transition this a little bit to what you're doing at Innovative Impact? Because I think when I met you at AFB, I started, you know, moving with what we were doing at Clean Logic, and we started talking about how we wanted to hire people with disabilities. And then you had left AFB and you started Innovative Impact and started consulting. And I know you had picked up other companies, but I think where I found Kirk to really be a strong advocate is he really does believe in hiring people with disabilities, especially people with vision loss. So Kirk, could you take us down the path of what you're trying to do with Innovative Impact and maybe some of the projects outside of what you've done for us at Clean Logic to really get companies to hire people with disabilities?
Right. So that's my passion. You know, only 35% of us with significant disabilities, including blindness, are in the workforce. So, you know, of working age adults in the general population, about 70% of people are employed. So we're at about half. And that means there's a lot of poverty and a lot of all the bad things that go along with poverty as far as the life outcomes and quality of life. So I'm really passionate about creating pathways for people who are blind and people with other disabilities to move into meaningful careers. And to earn a living and to have the financial wherewithal to make life choices according to how they see themselves thriving. So there's a book. I'm a researcher, so I reference books. So Forces for Good is a book that looks at 12 kind of transformational social movements, and City Year is one, Habitat for Humanity is another one. And they basically say in order to make anything really big happen, you have to align the government, the corporate, the nonprofit, and the community. And that's really what I do in various forms and fashions when I work with a company. First we have the conversation about why hire people with disabilities, and it's not hire the Handicap Charitable Act. It's because it gives you a strategic advantage. And again, a book like The Talent Code talks about how do people develop strengths. It's through meeting and overcoming increasingly difficult challenges. And, you know, if you're going to be a chess champion or a concert musician or a Olympic athlete, you're going to be set increasingly difficult challenges, you know, intentionally, methodically, on purpose. But living with impairments, whether it's visual, hearing, physical, cognitive, in this world that isn't designed to fit well with our impairments, you face and overcome challenges all day long. You do creative problem solving all day long. You communicate with people all day long in order to thrive. So, people with disabilities develop strengths that are really unique around things like resilience and perseverance and creative problem solving and, you know, communication skills and being able to work in teams. So I have that conversation with employers, and then oftentimes they think, I could hire some people with disabilities. They could do some packaging. You know, they could do some simple handwork. And then we have the conversation about you could have disabled people in accounting and marketing and human resources and quality control, of course, in production. So we kind of expand that vision. And then I really do what I said before. I bring the right people from the government, typically the vocational rehabilitation system, which has got a $4 billion budget and agencies in every state. And their job is to help you as an employer to hire people with disabilities successfully, and then connect with some of the nonprofits in the community that have philanthropic dollars and intent on employment. And then with other corporations that are farther down the path in the community. So I bring the stakeholders together who all share the common goal of better employment outcomes for people with disabilities, but they're oftentimes not working together. So I bring the right people around the table.
That's great. Thank you.
Yeah. Amazing. I know we're running low on time, Dr. Adams, but I, before we go, again, I mentioned this at the beginning of the show and throughout it, but I have such a an immense respect for Helen Keller and what she's done for people with disabilities in not only in America, but throughout the world. And I feel like most people, if you ask them about Helen Keller, know her, you know, they know, oh, they heard about her in elementary school.
Yeah, and like, the miracle worker, the water pump.
Right. Yeah. And like, right. That's basically it as far as their right. exposure. They know of her, but they don't really know yeah. how it affects their life.
Yeah, I can tell you in the 1930s, she and Eleanor Roosevelt basically started the talking book program with the Library of Congress.
Yes.
AFB pioneered the talking book, and the 33 and a third RPM phonograph record was developed to record books for blind people.
Amazing.
And then she went state by state and talked to state legislatures about creating commissions for the blind in every state to facilitate wow. employment. And that is yeah. our vocational rehabilitation system today. The blindness agencies were created first, and then states created agencies to support people with other disabilities. And that was very much directly because of her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, also she found one of the founding members of the ACLU. I mean,
yeah. If the NAACP, yeah. ACLU, she was a justice warrior.
A force. She was a force. And if you are listening to this, you're watching our show, like, I implore you, please Google her and spend some time learning about Helen Keller. She is one of the most impressive individuals that ever lived, really.
And I'll tell you, when I was at AFB, we received some grants and we digitized that whole archive. So if you go to afb.org and click on Helen Keller archive, it's all there. It's all searchable. It's fully accessible. Anything that was handwritten, we transcribed it so people with screen readers can read it all. So it's amazing. It's all there for you.
Hey, she's what's put us where we're at. When I talk about stuff yeah. we're doing in public speaking, and I always kind of close with, you know, we've all been working to really advance the lives of people with disabilities. And I yeah. really feel we're here at the tipping point. And I want to make sure we get one of the things from Dr. Kirk Adams here, because
yeah.
my biggest thing that I talk about is the number one reason people don't hire people with disabilities is because of fear. Mm-hmm. Dr. Kirk Adams, what are some of the advice that you could give companies, employers, of why fear should not be part of it? I just want to make sure we get this here, because this yeah. is what we're working for, and we want to yeah. keep beating it up yeah. and talking about it.
Well, I think it's just lack of knowledge, lack of experience, lack of exposure to people with disabilities. How do people with impairments function? What tools, technologies, techniques do we use? I certainly had my challenges getting my first job out of college because of preconceived notions that the employers had. I think visiting Clean Logic would be a really good thing to do. Visiting one of the nonprofits in your community that employ people with disabilities, so you can see how the technology is working, how people are operating with computers, for instance. I took my first consulting client on a field trip to Anderson, South Carolina, where Randy Lewis, when he was with Walgreens, constructed their warehouse and distribution center intentionally to employ people with developmental disabilities. So 40% of their employees have disabilities there. It's their most productive of their 20 warehouse and distribution centers. Lowest turnover, lowest absenteeism, best safety, best employee morale, best customer perception. So I can talk all day, but I certainly have brought lots of people into tour the Seattle Lighthouse, and you'll see 120 blind and deafblind machinists, using computer numerically controlled machining equipment to make to machine parts for all the Boeing aircraft, and to say, there's 2,000 different distinct part numbers made right here in every Boeing plane. So I think showing is better than telling.
That's great.
Well, look, this has been incredibly enlightening, and it's been an honor to have you on the show, and it's been incredible to learn about your journey and what you're working on and everything that's going on. with your foundation. And honestly, and again, I could talk about the Helen Keller stuff all day long, because again, I just think that she is, everybody, like I said, everybody knows who she is, but I think very few know about the depths of her, the impact her that she's impact. Had on this country.
Yeah.
And the world, really. And I think it's amazing. And the fact that you are helping to carry on her mission is incredible. And I just want to thank you for that.
Yeah. And if anyone wants to get in touch with me, I'm on LinkedIn every day. It's Kirk Adams, PhD on LinkedIn. And then I have a website, drkirkadams.com.
And you also have a podcast,
I have a newsletter,
right?
And my podcasts are there, and there's YouTube and all the things. So,
man, you're like the busiest guy in America right now.
Yeah. And I'm still proud. I'm one of the first ones there on the podcast. So I'm glad to see it's moving there. Kirk, it's been amazing. Yeah. So.
Yes, sir. Well, Dr. Adams, thank you again. Again, we appreciate you guys listening. If you like the show, you want to help us out, remember, tell a friend to continue to like, subscribe, comment, and share. We appreciate it, and we will see you next time on Driven by Purpose. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Kirk Adams.